Hello there, and welcome back to Peace in Their Time, episode 167. It's a hard knock Soviet life. The period of rapid industrialization within the Soviet Union during the first half of the 30s brought yet another round of sweeping changes into the daily lives of Soviet citizens. And to be clear, we're still focusing on the urban citizens here, less than a decade after the conclusion of the revolution and civil war. As we've been covering for weeks now, it was a period of calculated deprivation, when sacrifices were called upon in order to build up future prosperity. And again, to be sure, the average person was not consulted for this, but was willing to give the massive initiatives coming out of Moscow a chance. As I've mentioned in the past, they probably didn't anticipate how chaotic things would get and how distorted material conditions would become. I've already talked a bit on the food and housing shortages that resulted from the dislocations of these years, and they are usually held up as a warning against communism in the Western histories. But saying that people were hungry and that they were cold and that they had to go to great lengths just to get the basics, well, it's all a bit simplistic, which is why today I'm going to be discussing in greater detail the effect that rapid industrialization had on daily life in the cities. It's a long story that covers pretty much every aspect of daily life. Now, the standard of living in the USSR before the first five-year plan was already low, about on par with a developing country, which, to be frank, that's what the Soviet Union was by that time. But while people lacked consumer goods, they at least had reliable access to food. The Nepmen ensured that stores were stocked up, and while most people weren't getting a terribly varied diet, they got by in a relatively healthy manner. With the liquidation of the Nepmen and the assumption of control over their retail stores by the state, massive confusion was introduced into the food supply, only made worse by the inexperience of government agents in running such operations. And that was just a mild start to what was to come, as collectivization disrupted not just the conduit of the food supply, but the very source of it. Meanwhile, on the consumer goods front, and on this I'm talking about clothes, appliances, basic household stuff in addition to life's small luxuries, this was also a time of wanting. Priority, and by that I mean investment, resource allocation, and labor assignments, overwhelmingly favored heavy industry. Which meant that as the urban population expanded with people leaving the countryside and staffing the new factories and operations supporting those new factories, the industrial base to provide basic necessities was not properly expanded, nor was what existed already supported sufficiently. This, of course, meant shortages of every kind, leading to new patterns of life. Shops would put on impressive displays in their storefronts, but inside would be empty of any goods to actually buy. This was especially true of appliances made of metal, as those materials were being sent to expanding the factories. Getting something as simple as a kitchen knife or a tea kettle was borderline impossible for years. The legendary coups of the Stalinist period began at this time, with their worst years being here in the early 30s. Not just for food, people queued up for clothes and other basic necessities. A kind of black market formed, a bit more cautious in nature compared to the one that formed in the Civil War days, but still based on who you knew and if your name had sufficient weight to commandeer a desired item or items. I'm pulling a lot today from Sheila Fitzpatrick's excellent book Everyday Stalinism, and a phrase that became prominent in the lexicon of Soviet cities was getting a hold of something. Not buying outright, that's too specific. It wasn't enough to have money, you had to be at the right place at the right time to get a hold of something. People would carry around little shopping bags on their daily rounds, not with the intent to fill it with something specific that they had in mind, but if opportunity presented itself, and let's say a shop actually had something in stock by chance, or if someone was encountered willing to part with a desirable item, well, it was best to get a hold of it immediately. Like, say there were a new pair of shoes on offer. You might not necessarily need the shoes yourself at that exact second, but eventually yours would wear out, and God only knew when you'd get a chance to get another pair. Or if you were confident or feeling lucky that things would work out later, you could flip the shoes and negotiate something else you immediately wanted from somebody else. It is important to note that the people did not have a sense that they were living in the midst of a cataclysm. From the day-to-day street level, it all appeared as though that the shortages would be a temporary thing that would pass in time. Keep in mind that people were not resigned to live permanent lives of drudgery here, and the many years of these shortages would understandably leave a mark on the people. It would make them hardier and more self-sufficient, sure, but it wasn't quite suffered with a smile. The initial serious shortages occurred around the end of 1929, and the national mood almost immediately turned dark, as people were not at all happy about the reductions to a food supply that was never that impressive to begin with. Compared with the pre-revolutionary days, the average worker in the darkest days of 1933 was getting only half the bread and a fifth of the meat he otherwise would have gotten in the days of the NEP. Attempts to introduce materials into the supply of bread to expand how much was technically on hand also didn't do much to impress, as people could recognize the taste of sawdust pretty readily. To be sure, this was not a permanent state of affairs, and the latter half of the decade would see fitful improvements which spurned hope for the future. Then, of course, the war would come and ruin all that and send the people back into deprivation. But even in the back half of the 30s, there would still be bad harvests, which in turn would cause food shortages, even though they would never got quite as bad as the early part of the decade. The kolkhoz stalls were a minor relief. These were the little kiosks where peasants could sell the excess of their private plot on a quasi-open market. And I say minor because despite these emissaries from the countryside bringing in much-needed food for sale, their offerings weren't sufficient to alleviate the situation across the country. This had a good deal to do with peasants simply not being allowed to grow as much. Remember that one-acre restriction that was itself a concession granted through the most gritted of teeth from the leadership in terms of what peasants had as a private plot. That was all the peasants on the kolkhoz had in which to make a little for themselves and to sell in the city markets. This also meant that while they were offering agricultural goods in the shortest of supply, like meat, eggs, or dairy, the prices being charged were prohibitive for normal people, leaving their goods to be snapped up by those with access to real resources, both monetary or material. In fact, those kolkhoz markets became little black markets in and of themselves, with many of the goods changing hands officially prohibited from on high, but almost always they were tolerated by local officials. The city dwellers would offer what little manufactured goods they had to spare in exchange for some choice agricultural ones. For the average worker, though, things like fruit and butter were available only to look at sadly through the windows of a handful of high-end grocery stores in the biggest of cities. Consumer goods were in a similar state, not just because of shortages, but because of the slapdash nature of their construction. Remember back from previous episodes how I talked about how sky-high production quotas were demanded of every factory, and even though consumer good factories were very much the stepchildren of the five-year plan, those same standards applied. Handles fell off appliances, clothes and shoes were in such disrepair that they quickly fell apart. The worst was that many people had the skills or at least knew somebody that could fix those things up. Even a poorly made coat at least presented material that could be stitched up into something workable. But there were shortages of basic goods like thread, needles, spare cloth. And the supply of shoes was in a constant state of crisis, one that would not be eased by the end of the decade. I discussed previously that during the early days of collectivization, that peasants slaughtered their animals en masse, reducing the overall availability of livestock in the long term. This meant that supplies of leather were curtailed drastically. Then there was the crackdown on private manufacturers and cobblers, culminating in 1931 when it was announced that for the entire year that shoe production would be authorized only through state-run enterprises. The quality coming out of those enterprises was terrible, and the government was forced to backtrack on allowing private individuals to operate. But even with this concession, the crisis of shoes and other footwear never went away and represented one of the worst sources of shortages, oftentimes even a worse problem than the food supply. The professional handyman became almost extinct during the period, as basic supplies like paint or nails became unavailable. You really had to watch what you owned and be sure and take excellent care of everything, as once it was gone, it could not be replaced anytime soon. There was the option of stealing from state-controlled storage or construction sites, but that was not a solution to a nationwide problem and carried with it some obvious risks. The state tried to explain away the crippling shortages with accusations of wrecking from their enemies. Once again, the evil Kulak makes an appearance, as having been forced from the countryside, they turn to the cities to find new ways to undermine the revolution. Foreign objects were implanted into bread dough, shoe production was sabotaged, vile rumors were started to create a panic that would lead to massive lineups outside food stores. The government realized the scale of the problem, but could do little about it given their priorities were elsewhere. Lines thousands of people long formed outside of stores. Foot traffic, hell, even vehicle traffic, was badly disrupted by the sheer mass of people that formed whenever word got out that there was something on hand to actually buy. Rationing was put into place from 1929 to 1935, despite leadership being unenthusiastic, seeing it correctly as an admission of defeat, and that shortages were sticking around for a while. This was wildly unpopular among the people, as suddenly state and party officials became gatekeepers for necessities. And the state liked playing their favorites, with industrial workers getting top priority for allotments, while the dwindling private merchants being assigned the least priority. Enemies of the state, like priests or those labeled as kulaks, didn't receive the right to a ration at all and were left off the system to fend for themselves. And the privileged workers would not have to suffer standing in the public queues either. When they were handed out their allotments of food and goods, it was done in the factories themselves, away from the eyes of the public. Mess halls for the workers became another privilege, offering perhaps the only consistent supply of warm food to those workers. In the major cities, these cafeterias, coming to number around 30,000 by 1933, were serving between half and two-thirds of the working population. It was an enormous enterprise that was also a hallmark of the shared experience of those days. Closed distribution stores, peaking at around 40,000 such places, were established to give workers a chance to buy consumer goods and bypass the public stores. These outlets came to represent a third of retail shops in the entire union. For shops selling outside the rationing system entirely, this didn't mean free enterprise, it meant mandated high prices, with, for example, shoes going for quadruple the price found in the ration shops. Sugar was 8 times the price. The disparity was leveled going into the middle of the decade, but the dominance of state enterprises was never again challenged, with private shops amounting to, at best, a quarter of retail activity. Which isn't to say that simple shortages were the only source of trouble affecting the movement of urban life. Far from it. The mass influx of people overwhelmed public services, and the same shortages affecting consumers also affected city planners. There simply were not resources available to do everything the state was demanding. I'm going to leave out the industrial boom towns like Magnitogorsk for these examples because they were such extreme ones, which I already covered just a couple weeks ago anyway. But the existing cities had their own experiences to tell. Most, at least, had existing public transportation services like buses or trolleys, and Moscow was fortunate to see the establishment of its famous and strikingly beautiful metro. But Moscow, as you might be able to guess, was kind of a special case and received special treatment, as it was the most foreign-facing of the USSR cities. Outside the capital, things weren't great. Okay, I'll be honest, things in a lot of Moscow itself weren't great either. Those workers' barracks I talked about a couple weeks ago were the default accommodations for newcomers. Even when new apartment buildings were constructed, they often were built without proper running water, which included their sewage systems. Supplies of electricity were limited in these new districts that cropped up as new workers crammed into the cities. And you know how I just talked about the endangered nature of the humble handyman? Well, if you already lived in the cities and had proper accommodations, well, first of all, good for you. But holy hell, you better pray to the God that you were very discouraged from believing in that nothing bad happened to your apartment during these years, because help wasn't on its way, and even if it was, they probably didn't have replacement parts on hand. Sanitation was a nightmare. The barracks didn't have sewer connections. New buildings very likely didn't. Sometimes entire cities didn't. Stalingrad, site of the premier tractor factory of the Union, didn't have sewers at all despite hosting a population of around 500,000. The cities of Siberia were mostly without sewers, electricity, and even proper heating systems. Imagine living in a flimsy workers' barrack in Siberia. Not going to have a good time there. Disease, as a result, skyrocketed, and public health descended into near-crisis levels. all those workers and their families crammed into barracks without proper sanitation, eating in communal spaces, and with virtually no heating meant diseases like typhus and even dysentery were common. The lack of proper food assuredly did not help matters. The barracks and ramshackle apartments of the new districts and cities also lacked proper paved streets, and they took on the character of frontier towns on the outskirts of established communities. Where cities did have public transportation, they didn't reach out to these new areas, and the workers there had to hoof it either all the way to work or at least to the nearest station to get picked up, which meant that the public buses and trams were badly overloaded, and during rush hours heading to and from work, it meant that you were packed in like a sardine and could expect to be badly delayed. These new areas were also poorly policed, as local law enforcement was itself overwhelmed with the newcomers. I used the phrase frontier town very deliberately for my American listeners, because if you're thinking of a chaotic, unplanned, dirty sprawl of half-assed buildings populated by restless and stressed-out drunks, that's exactly what I want you to imagine. It was a rowdy atmosphere, and many of the people were unused to the urban setting, or at least had a prior stint of the cities cut short by some other disaster that forced them back to the countryside at an earlier date. These were dislocated people, and despite us knowing now in the present that their achievements in developing the USSR would be successful, they had no way of knowing themselves what their ultimate fate would be. The grim resignation in the face of chronic uncertainty was a palpable feeling. The will of the state had made it impossible for them to remain in the countryside. Nobody knew if another edict from the top would scatter them to the four winds all over again. That everybody was constantly hungry, sick, and cold also added to the tensions. It wore on people, and violence, robberies, pretty much all the bad crimes, saw an increase. Street gangs saw a resurgence, mirroring their prominence during the bad old days of the Civil War, and this included both youths and adults. Walking the streets at night was a good way to get mugged or worse. It was bad enough in some places that factory workers getting off their shifts in the evening opted to sleep in the factory rather than run the gauntlet back to their homes. This wave of crime spread into older sections of cities as well as conditions grew worse, and vandals and pickpockets were a constant fact of life on the streets of Soviet cities. Then there was the kind of everyday corruption born of practicality that permeated down to the very bones of Soviet society, best expressed with the term blot, or in English, pull, meaning that one had to have pull with others in order to get anything done. Having blot meant having friends and relatives in useful places. It meant you yourself being able to offer something useful, and it meant being able to make your connections available for still more favors. You can look at it as a kind of network of patronage, as the high and mighty with access to goods doled out their trinkets in exchange for loyalty and other favors. Or in the case of the battered intelligentsia, it meant cozying up with the higher-ups in the party and government to give the system a veneer of progressiveness, while at the same time securing their own livelihoods. Quite the contrary to the image of a Soviet society marching in lockstep towards the dictates of the Central Planning Committees, the lives of the citizens were oftentimes spent in a dizzying whirlwind of wheeling and dealing, constantly making arrangements to better survive the hard times. To have blot meant you knew the speculators and thieves who snatched up goods out of the state-run supply chains, and it meant that people inside the Communist Party listened to you. I've mentioned before that factory workers got special privileges, which made those jobs highly desirable. Being able to secure a family member a job like that meant you had blot. To have blot was almost a matter of life and death. To have it meant access to what it took to survive. Not having it meant you were at the mercies of a system in perpetual crisis and constantly chasing bigger priorities. You want some work done in your apartment? You need to know a guy. You want access to buy even a bad pair of shoes? You gotta know a guy. Or you had to be able to bribe them at the very least. You needed something. The dire state of affairs in the USSR in the 30s was such that everybody was looking for a means to survive, and this was an expression of that. It wasn't popular, mind you, just that if you didn't get yours out of the system, then you get nothing, and that's no good. But I usually portray normal Soviets of the era as idealistic, and I stand by that. They complained of the system, and state and party officials kicked reports of the discontent up the chain. But again, the state was wrapped up so much in the big projects that resources couldn't be spared to crack down on it. And it was the responsibilities that the state undertook over just a few years that made the whole situation worse, at least in the short term. Collectivization, rapid industrialization, the vast majority of retail and food stores, the entirety of the supply chains linking all these things together, it strained the capacity of the state and the party to actually oversee, and the natural result was corruption on a vast scale. You simply do not create institutions capable of expertly managing these things overnight the way Stalin and his team were attempting. This is an echo of an earlier instance during the Civil War when the bureaucracy was expanded by bringing in common workers into the ever larger offices of the state. It led to short-term inefficiency and corruption as the inexperienced took on roles new to them with little training. But then, as eventually happened after the 30s, there arose wholly new institutions better suited to the USSR, which allowed the state to function and respond more capably than they had in the past. The interesting thing here is that the Soviet leadership in those years was capable of accepting the short-term pain instead of coasting on the existing status quo. And despite everything I've been describing today, more than enough people were willing to work in the terribly imperfect conditions they found themselves in for the promise of a better day. They saw the experience they were going through as a kind of rebirth into a modern industrialized society. And that was directly reinforced within the press that the hard work that they did would change the world. Even in the infamous gulags that began to be established at the end of the 20s, there was a push towards the inmates buying into the Soviet promise through their incredibly forced labor. And people in the camps actually responded positively, at least among those who believed themselves to not be totally screwed. There was also the Stakhanovite movement, named after the famed coal miner Alexei Stakhanov, who claimed to have mined over 100 tons of coal in 6 hours in August 1935, and then outdoing himself by mining 227 tons in a shift just weeks later. There is no small debate of the validity of his claims, but really he was just the face of a movement that was already well underway by the time he rose to prominence. It was basically a competition encouraged by the state to increase output still more than the breakneck pace of the early 30s already demanded. Workers would push themselves nearly to the breaking point, but in doing so advance the interests of the state, and if they were successful and could prove themselves useful thereafter in pushing a propagandist line to their comrades, then they could expect some nice privileges as a result. There was a kind of education requirement on top of that. Ambassadors of intense labor were expected, after all, to be eloquent in pushing their message of pulling out all the stops at work. But the state was willing to play ball on that and get those common, but also very intense workers up to speed on that front. And the rewards could be well worth the effort. If industrial workers got access to special closed stores, then Stakhanovites got access to even more exclusive ones. They were supplied with rare consumer goods, both as a reward and to make sure that when they appeared for propaganda purposes, that they cut dashing figures, always being able to say honestly that they were well taken care of. And it wasn't just the Stakhanovites that were expected to better themselves. Towards the closing years of the first five-year plan, pressure on the managers, engineers, and planners in the industrial sector started to ease. As discussed earlier, the calculated repression to make them loyal to Stalin had been carried out, so ruling through the carrot instead of the stick when it came to them started to become more practical. The white-collar workers were indeed granted special access to goods and services, and their blot correspondingly was very high compared to normal people. This came with responsibilities, though, as, like the Stakhanovites, they were expected to educate themselves. And I don't just mean go to the theater and read approved literature, although that was part of it. It also meant they had to stay up to date on the technical side of their professions. The circumstance of pre-revolutionary factory managers growing old and losing touch with what was considered up to date through the 20s was not to be repeated. The Soviet middle manager was expected to be world class. Although this was a very tricky thing, given that with the expansion of industry and the economy in general, that a lot of people were very new to their positions. That in and of itself was not a bad thing, and it spoke to the potential for social mobility within the USSR, at least in the cities. It involved a certain amount of luck, but millions saw themselves as on the pathway to a life they otherwise couldn't have dreamed of elsewhere in the Union. And yes, I realize what I'm saying compared to the reality, and again, I mean that people thought in terms of the future, or for the more desperate peasants coming in from the countryside, they simply came from such a dire place that even the rough cities weren't all that bad. All the stress and tension, though, did lead to increased pressures on the family. Remember, whenever I talk about cramped apartments and workers' barracks, it's not just the laborers living there. Their families were right there with them. The cohesion of the Soviet family ultimately depended on the mother, seeing as how the father was typically working long shifts at their place of employment. The vast majority of people waiting in the sprawling queues were women, as were the people doing a little bit of trade on the sly to better support their families. This was all on top of the traditional housekeeping and child-rearing that women were expected to do. And this brings me to close out the episode on the topic of the retreat from the revolutionary family values that were played up during the 20s. If you recall back in episode 102, I covered the early USSR demonstrating what would have been for the day a shocking amount of progressiveness. Divorce was legal and made fairly easy, abortion was legalized, women were encouraged to seek out employment, and the entire idea of the family began to be challenged by the more zealous of the party. But that kind of thinking started to burn itself out in the face of social realities by the end of the 1920s. I discussed last season that women weren't actually all that thrilled with how easy divorce was in practice, as it meant that men could more easily abandon their families. The same feeling went for open relationships that bypassed marriage altogether. Abortions were legal, but never terribly common, and while women certainly entered the workforce in large numbers, the idea of the family held together even in the face of enormous pressure. The 1930s marked a time of social conservatism that usually gets held up as a black mark against Stalin, as he endorsed the rollbacks back towards tradition, which is entirely fair, as in the case of abortion, for example, if it wasn't that common, it really shouldn't have been an issue that really needed addressing. The widespread support of women for creating tighter marriages I'll respect, though, because, yeah, I can really see a lot of guys skipping out the second, things start getting tough. Which, hey, blame the man was actually kind of a state line during the 1930s. Women were held up in propaganda as more level-headed, patient, and possessing of nobler intention, which meant guys who were portrayed as flighty drunks in the propaganda could take a lesson from them. I know I bounced around this week, but I do hope that this grab bag of topics has given you a good grasp of what people had to deal with in their day-to-day lives during the Stalinist period. As I've hopefully laid out in exhausting detail, the early 30s were the worst years when it came to dislocations in people's daily lives. But there would be periodic crises in the back half of the decade as well. And then things would just get a whole lot worse during the 40s on account of, the whole war of annihilation thing. But that's kind of a point I want this episode to highlight, because the Soviet people went through a whole lot during the 30s, with more still that I haven't covered yet. They did so with the expectation that material circumstances would improve, which did appear to be the case, sort of. Even during the late 30s, there would be new dislocations in producing goods for the simple fact that much of the industrial investment switched to military production on account of the worsening political situation leading up to World War II. And then the war pretty much negated all progress entirely and sent people's material conditions back to the bad old days, which I cannot imagine people were happy about, and I would like to posit played no small role in improving the Soviet fighting spirit, because this was a people who had walked through the fire with the promise of something good on the other end, but then some Germans decided to come in like thieves in the night just as they started seeing some results. They weren't about to let them get away with that. As Soviet soldiers were quick to point out after entering Germany in 1944 and 45, why the hell did you invade us when you have so much and we have so little? Words of a people denied enjoying the fruits of their labor that they had planted with so much hope in these years that I have been covering. And speaking of worsening situations, next week I'll take an episode to take stock of the USSR's international position during the early 1930s and how the first five-year plan affected its dealings abroad. If you've been missing foreign affairs coverage, rejoice, that'll be all in next week's episode. And it'll actually be the last episode of this mini-series. But don't worry, I'll be coming back later in the season for much more on the USSR. So, join me then, and as always, thank you very much for listening.